Is it on? Oh, yeah. Thank you all for coming to the second installment of the Jewish Center Young Leadership Lecture Series. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Michal Greenspan, and on behalf of the entire committee, and specifically Caleb Koffler and Rabbi Zirkin, I just want to say thank you so much for coming tonight. I want to give a really quick thank you to Caleb and Rabbi Zirkin, because even though I'm standing here, they did really the bulk of the work for this. Before we get started, I just wanted to give a brief overview of the Young Leadership Lecture Series. The goal of the series is to find speakers and topics that we thought would be of interest to the young professional community. Thanks for everyone who already gave us ideas and reached out to speakers for us. Because of you, we have a really exciting lineup for the spring semester and really good leads for the rest of the year. That being said, if you have any ideas of speakers or topics or both, please feel free to find us afterwards and let us know. We are open to any and all suggestions. Before we begin, I also just want to give you a quick schedule update for the rest of the semester of the lectures. So on Wednesday, April 5th, we'll be hearing from Rabbi Zirkin on 10 tips for tenants, everything a renter needs to know for Pesach, and there'll be a live chametz sale. Then on Sunday, April 23rd, we'll have a Yom HaShoah program. On Monday, May 29th, we'll be hearing from Rabbi Daniel Hartman of the Shalom Hartman Institute, and he'll be speaking about his book, Putting God Second, and there'll be a Q&A to follow. And then in June, I don't remember the exact date, sorry.
June 29th.
May 15th is Daniel Hartman, and then June 29th, we'll be hearing from Dr. Batsheva Lerner-Maslow about infertility and halacha. Now for tonight's lecture. Tonight we'll be hearing about the Ahuna crisis from Rabbi Jeremy Stern, the Executive Director of ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Ahunot. By working within the parameters of halacha and civil law, ORA advocates for the timely and unconditional issuance of a get. Through Ahuna case advocacy, emotional support, get subsidies, and educational initiatives for Ahuna prevention, ORA not only helps those who are struggling to obtain a get, but also seeks to foster a community in which a get is never used as a weapon. So now, I would like to welcome Rabbi Stern, who will tell us more about the Ahuna crisis and about what ORA does.
Okay. Thank you so much, Michal. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Rabbi Zirkin as well for inviting me to come. I don't want this to be a frontal lecture. I very much want to engage with you and hear your thoughts and questions. So I'm going to share some information, but I really want to hear your input. So as the executive director of ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Aguna, we work on individual Aguna cases as a primary, the bread and butter of what we do. We've assisted in the resolution of 283 Aguna cases since our founding in 2002, and at any given time, we're working on 70 active Aguna cases. But let's just start off by defining some terms and explaining kind of the parameters of how this issue is created. Can someone define for me what an Aguna is? What's an Aguna? Yeah, and tell me your first name so I can know your names. Naomi. Because they're not given a get for what reason?
Refusal for whatever power, whatever reason.
Okay, right. So as Naomi said, that one definition of an aguna, you can have an agun as well, a man who is chained to a dead marriage because his wife is not complying with the get process. But as Naomi said, the contemporary type of aguna that we have is a situation where a woman is chained to a dead marriage. The term aguna comes from the Hebrew word ogen, which means an anchor. A woman is anchored or chained to a dead marriage because the husband is recalcitrant. Right, he's refusing to issue her a get. Right, he's non-compliant. He's required by halacha to give her a get. He's refusing to do so. That's the contemporary type of aguna that we find nowadays. That's really what my organization works on. But there's a different type of aguna, the classical aguna that's dealt with in the Gemara and in generations gone by, and with a few exceptions or a few situations in the modern era. What's the other type of aguna?
Something that goes to war.
And what happens? What's your name? Ron.
Someone that goes to war, and it's unclear if he dies in battle.
Right. So if a man is missing in action or lost at sea, we don't know whether he's dead or alive. His wife is chained to a dead marriage until we can ascertain whether or not he has died. Meaning that they were halachically married, and now he's lost at sea or gone off to war. He's missing in action. If he's dead, then she can't be married to a dead man, right? They're no longer halachically married. Their marriage is over, and she can move on and remarry.
But if he's alive, then they are still halachically married until he either returns or, again, if they have evidence to indicate that he has died. And what are the consequences for a woman to be in this status as an aguna chained to a dead marriage? So what? So she doesn't have a get? Well, what are the consequences for that? What does it mean for her? She can't remarry, right? And if she does civilly remarried, engages in an intimate relationship with another man, that relationship is? It's okay, not okay. It's adultery, right? That relationship is adultery, and the children would be, everyone always knows this one, mamzerim, right? The children would be mamzerim, illegitimate children, which means they effectively can't marry within the Jewish community. So the consequences for a woman to be in the status of an aguna, to be chained to a dead marriage, right, to be unable to remarry, these consequences are really devastating because she can't rebuild her family, get remarried, and in many ways move on with her life. She has the get hanging over her, which is holding her back. So one other point of introduction before we get to some of the work that we do and how we work on individual aguna cases, which is a fundamental distinction between halachic marriage and divorce and civil marriage and divorce. How does one get civilly married here in the United States? What do you need to get? A marriage? Say it out loud, right? A marriage license, right? So marriage license is a lot like a driver's license, right? In the sense that it is a document issued by the state. The lawyers in the room, who's a lawyer? Okay, good, no lawyers, all right. Then they won't get tripped up on legal issues. I come from a family of attorneys. My father is still upset at me that I never went to law school. So instead I became a rabbi. So in the civil law system, right, how does one get civilly married? You get a marriage license, which is a lot like a driver's license in the sense that it is a certificate of permission issued by the state, which declares that such an individual is legally allowed to operate a motor vehicle, or in the marriage context, on the matrimonial context, by the power invested in me by the state of New York, I now pronounce you husband and wife, right? The judge or the justice of peace or the priest or the rabbi, right, acting as an officiant of the state, is pronouncing the couple civilly married. Civil marriage is a status that is imposed by a third party, namely the state. Right, the state is pronouncing the couple civilly married, and so too in civil divorce. Right, a civil divorce is a decree that's issued by a judge. The judge, poof, pronounces the couple civilly divorced, and that is how they get civilly divorced. Halachic marriage and divorce is fundamentally different. Right, the secret they teach us in rabbinical school is that rabbis play no fundamental role under the chuppah. Right, the rabbi is there to look good and to wear his tux or whatever, and to make sure that everything that is done under the chuppah is done correctly. Right, he's the misader kiddushin, the misader kiddushin. He arranges the kiddushin, but correct me if I'm wrong. The rabbi plays no fundamental role under the chuppah. True or false? True, right? The rabbi is not pronouncing the couple halachically married. He's not saying, poof, here you're now hereby halachically married. Rather, who are the key players in the halachic marriage process? It's a private transaction between the bride and groom, which makes them the wife and the husband. It is a private transaction between the two of them. They have two witnesses to certify that this act has indeed taken place. But fundamentally, it is a private transaction that's taking place between the two of them. They may invite 500 of their closest family and friends to witness it and to celebrate with them and things like that. But they could do it in a broom closet, right? Without anyone seeing, without any rabbi witnessing it or anything along those lines. It's a private transaction between the two of them. And unlike in the civil divorce process, where if one party is non-compliant or not willing to participate willingly in the process, the civil judge can pronounce the couple civilly divorced. In halachic marriage, since it's a private transaction between the two of them, and you require the participation of both parties in the marriage process, the same goes for the divorce process, that we require the participation of both parties, both the husband and the wife, in the halachic divorce process. The challenge is that, whereas it's relatively simple, once a couple decides that they want to get halachically married, for them to figure out where, when, and under what terms and conditions they will get halachically married, when it comes to the halachic divorce process, and there's a breakdown in communication between the two sides, and they may not be speaking with each other at all, and certainly joint decision-making has become very difficult, it becomes a real challenge for them to agree on where, when, and under what conditions they will get halachically divorced. And that could degenerate into a situation of protracted recalcitrance. which is essentially a situation of a woman being chained to a dead marriage, and at that point, she is an aguna. So that's the modern aguna situation, and how halachic marriage and divorce, being fundamentally different than civil marriage and divorce, leads to that problem. Get refusal is largely a modern problem. Why do you think that is? What factors have contributed to this situation now? And we don't find responsa 100 years ago, 200 years ago, where you had guys, you know, married who are, you know, otherwise upstanding members of the Jewish community who are actively refusing to give their wives a get. Why do you think that is? It's really only a modern issue. My organization is dealing with scores of cases at any given time. This was never the case before. What's changed? Hoodie, it's not a frontal lecture. You got to read his name. What's changed in the modern era?
Prevalence of divorce,
right? A rise in divorce means that with more divorces, there are going to be more contentious divorces. With more contentious divorces, there will be more cases of recalcitrance. Absolutely, that's a factor. So, I went too ahead. Rise in divorce rate is one of them. What else? Yeah, name.
Jay. There's a legal system outside halacha.
Ooh, you guys are getting them in order. Dueling court systems, civil court versus the Beitin, right? And there's a lot of game playing that goes on based upon whichever system is going to be advantageous for one party or the other, right? And so that's a contributing factor. Is that what you were saying, or did I just...
Yeah.
Okay, run with it. Excellent. All right, any other factors? Let's see if you can get it in order. Any other factors? Yeah, name?
Elon. Women's economic empowerment is in
law. Oh my goodness. What is going on here? Empowerment of women in the civil divorce. What is going on here? All right. Empowerment of women in the civil divorce, in the civil court system, the civil divorce system, right? That women have what to gain in the civil divorce process. It's a much more equitable process now than it was in past generations. And so therefore, if women are going to get 50% of the marital assets, that means that the husband, he stands to gain by using to get his leverage in order to gain something from her, right? So that's another factor. What's next? I'll give you a hint on this one. Think about the Jewish community. What's different now than, let's say, in the shtetl, in terms of dealing with these cases occurring, or dealing with them? Yeah.
And
remind me your name.
Ron.
Ron.
More liquid money. To be held on the line. That's
true. Right. I guess I wrote empowerment of women in the civil court system, but really like empowerment of women in general, in terms of their financial, their you know, economic standing. All right, so that's a good point. You didn't get it in order, though. Okay. Naomi?
Something about people spreading out and moving to new cities.
Breakdown in communal cohesiveness, okay? Which is that it used to be that if a guy was breaking halacha, right, which is what these guys are doing, recalcitrant husbands are breaking the law. They're violating halacha, right? And if they were doing that and they lived in a shtetl, they'd be kicked out of shul and no one would speak with them and no one would do business with them and they would be a pariah in the community. They were done, right? And that was a tremendous amount of pressure on them. And so that was really effective in getting these guys to comply with the law, because otherwise they'd have no social standing, no economic transactions or anything along those lines. Okay, excellent. What else? Any other factors? Yeah, name.
Ariel.
Children, custody battles.
Okay, and what about it?
The husband would use the get as leverage.
Yeah, and so that's a factor which becomes a and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, which is one of the motivations for husbands to refuse to give their wives a get. But I mean, custody issues were always an issue. That wouldn't relate to get refusal being a modern problem specifically. Any other suggestions? So what I have here are a lack of enforcement power by a beitin, right, which is related to the communal cohesiveness issue, which is that in the shtetl, the beitin was the ruling body, right? If the beitin ruled that was the law of, that's not necessarily the land, but at least for the community. And so if the rabbis ruled that this guy had to give his wife a get, that's what everyone expected, and that's what was enforced. And the other issue is an ad hoc beitin system outside of Israel. In Israel, and to be, again, as I mentioned before, a man refusing to give his wife a get is breaking the law. He's violating halacha. In Israel, such an individual can be dealt with in the same way that any lawbreaker is dealt with. They can be put in jail. Their assets can be seized. They can be put in solitary confinement for refusing to give the wives a get. That's what you do with someone who breaks the law. Right? But thankfully, in the United States, we have a separation between church and state, which is a very wonderful thing. But the repercussion for that in this regard is that if a guy's refusing to give his wife a get, can we stick him in jail in the U.S.? We can't do that. We can't seize his assets, right? We can't put him in solitary. We can't penalize him or fine him or anything along those lines because of a separation between church and state. And so the Beitin system in Israel is the state-run system. The Beitin system is recognized by the state as a state system, whereas outside of Israel, it's an ad hoc Beitin system. There's no official Beitin. And so, if even, and this kind of relates to the previous one, if a Beit Din rules, they have no enforcement power, but also they don't intrinsically have any standing within the community. That you could have dueling Beit Dins within the same jurisdiction. You could have a Beit Din here and a Beit Din, down the block, and there's no standing for one Beit Din to have enforcement power over the other. So these are all contributing factors to the modern aguna problem. And so the way that Ores got involved is that we seek to eliminate abuse from the Jewish divorce process and work within the parameters of Jewish law and civil law to advocate for the timely and unconditional issuance of a get. And so just to give you a little bit of background, founded in 2002 by a group of YU students, who's a group of college students who heard about an aguna case and really like as an extracurricular activity. They started organizing peaceful demonstrations outside of the homes of places of business of recalcitrant husbands. And since then, we've grown as a nonprofit. We now have 8 full-time staff members. We've assisted in the resolution of over 280 aguna cases in 15 years. 70 active cases any given time. We receive 250 calls a year for assistance from people for assistance in the get or the Beit Din process. We have educational programming reaching nearly 4,000 students and community members. Rav Herschel Schaffler is our posek for these halachic issues. So often people say, well, beat him up, right? If a guy's refusing to give his wife a get, you should go ahead and beat him up. So why can't we do that in the United States? Because It's against the law, right? And there are rabbis who did just that, and now they're serving over a decade in jail for assault and battery and kidnapping and things along those lines. So it's against the law to beat people up. But not only that, it's not so simple from a halachic perspective. The Shulchan Aruch says as follows. Kol elu sha'amru lahotzi, kofin afilu v'shotim. Shulchan Aruch opens up and says, all those about whom it says in the Talmud, he should divorce. Right? The Gemara uses the term, a man should give his wife a get, we force him even with whips. Any situation where it says in the Gemara that a man should give his wife a get, we can beat him up, whip him, beat him, etc. And this is the approach of the Rambam. The Rambam has a very expansive approach of where you can physically coerce a guy to give his wife a get. He says any situation where it says in the Gemara that he should give a get, we can coerce him. V'yeish omrim, but there's a dissenting opinion that's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. And that's the approach of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says that shekomi shelo ne'amar bo b'gemar b'feirush, kofin lahotzi. Someone says that wherever it does not say in the Talmud, we force him to divorce, rather just says he should divorce. Rabbeinu Tam looks at the language of the Gemara and says, yes, there are situations where it says you can force the guy to give a get, but those are distinct from the situations where it says he should give his wife a get. And so therefore, the situations where it says you can force him to give a get, indeed you can force him, but all those other cases, which the vast majority of cases, where it just says he should give his wife a get without using the language kofin, that you can coerce him to give a get, we do not force him with rips, rather we say to him, the sages have obligated you to divorce, and if you do not, it is permissible to call you a sinner. And so Rabbeinu Tam, in having a much more limited application to physical coercion, he says it's limited to a very small group of cases, he opens up what we call harchakot de Rabbeinu Tam, which are the distancing measures, the communal sanctions of Rabbeinu Tam. And then the Rama expands upon this, quoting from Rabbeinu Tam, and says as follows. Since there is an argument among the sages, it is proper to be stringent not to coerce with whips, so that it should not be a forced get, which would be a get that's not valid. Nevertheless, and here's from the Rabbeinu Tam, we may declare on every Jew not to do him any favor, nor do business with him, nor circumcise his children, nor bury him until he divorces. and a Beit Din may add any stringency of this type. This is what we call harchakot de Rabbeinu Tam, communal sanctions, which essentially make apply social pressure on the husband to give his wife a get, and that's what my organization is really focused on in these individual cases. So this is the Aguna advocacy that we are involved in. So the types of cases that we take on are either where the Beit Din process has run its course, the Beit Din has issued a ruling stating that the husband is recalcitrant, and now we can apply communal sanctions and social pressure on him, or where the Beit Din process has stalled, and that could be, and this is the other type of case that we get involved with, where, as I mentioned before, outside of Israel, there's no official accreditation process for a Beit Din, right? How do you form a Beit Din? Three Jewish men can call themselves rabbis, and those three rabbis can call themselves a Beit Din. We can have the Beit Din of the fourth floor of the Jewish Center building, and that's suddenly now a Beit Din, right? And what can happen is the wife may say, I want to go to a credible, well-respected, well-regarded Beit Din that has published rules and procedures that we know to be fair. And the husband says, well, I don't want to go to that Beit Din. I want to go to my three buddies down the block who now call themselves a Beit Din, right? And that's where I want to do the to do the get. And the reason he says that, he's trying to use the get as leverage to gain concessions from the wife. And so the wife wants to go to Beit Din A, the husband wants to go to Beit Din B, and never the twain shall meet. And so we'll get involved in those cases to try to facilitate the process, to facilitate a Beit Din process so that eventually either the get is issued or a ruling against the husband or against the recalcitrant party is issued. And so our approach at Ora is first, we always try to facilitate an amicable resolution to the case. But if and when that doesn't work, and also, and I guess to expand upon that, what that means is opening lines of communication between the two parties, facilitating a Beit Din process, as I mentioned. And whenever we take on a case, we speak with everyone. We'll speak with both sides. We'll take the husband out for coffee or for pizza and say to him, look, we've heard from your wife. We want to hear from you about why you're not giving giving her a get. Let's see if there's any way that we can resolve the situation amicably by isolating the get from all other contentious issues in the divorce and ensure that the get is issued unconditionally and in a timely fashion. But if and when that doesn't work, we resort to using all forms of pressure, which are civilly permissible and halachically permissible, and that's our advocacy. So one of those things includes protest rallies. This is a rally we had in Brooklyn. About 100 people were there. We'll also, we launch social media campaigns against recalcitrant husbands. We'll ensure that he's not welcomed in his community. He's kicked out of shul. His family and friends are not supporting him. Anything we can do within the context of civil law and halacha to coerce him to give a get. And so what one of those cases looks like is, what that starts with, is this ruling from the Beit Din. This is a case that we're still working on, the case of Steve Shear and Erica Pollack. And this is what's called a seiruv, an order of contempt, that was issued by the Beit Din of America after Erica tried to get a get from the Beit Din. So it says, Stephen Shear has failed to appear in front of the Beit Din of America or an alternative Beit Din for the purpose of giving a get or submitting to Beit Din adjudication of Erica Pollack's request for a get. In the last paragraph, is Stephen Shear's conduct violates Jewish law? He's breaking the law. The issue is that we have so few forms of enforcement to try and coerce him to abide by the law. So we'll talk about Stephen just a bit, but what motivates a husband to refuse to issue a get? And we'll talk about Steve's motivation specifically, but what would motivate a man to refuse to give his wife a get? Why wouldn't he do it? Yeah, name.
Alex, if he doesn't like the man that she might want to marry.
Okay, so he's not going to give her a get in order to do what? So that his kids won't have a stepfather that he doesn't approve of. So he's not going to. That's interesting. I haven't seen a case like that. But you're onto something because there are elements of there that we have found in the cases that we've worked on. What else? What else might motivate a husband to refuse to give his wife a get? What are some contentious issues in a divorce? Yeah, name.
Lexi, if he's just angry and wants to punish her in some way.
Right. So he's going to pain her out of spite by refusing to give her the get, right? That's one motivation. What else? And we'll get to there. It's number three, so I can't jump to it. Rabbi Zorkin.
No longer religious.
Interesting. So sometimes they'll say that, but generally what happens in these cases is we say you were married in, you know, according to traditional Jewish law, and what we're asking you to do is sign a document that has no declaration of faith, but simply undoes what you had, you know, committed to many years ago. It will come at no cost to you and take 5 minutes of your time. Would you rather us have protest rallies against you or sign a document which you had agreed to in principle, at least to those principles of law previously, which again comes at no cost to you, and we'll just take a few minutes of your time. So they might state that, but there's something more underlying it. What else would motivate a husband? What are the major contentious issues in a divorce, Ron?
They still want to be married.
He does, right? He quote unquote loves her. That's number four. We'll get to that as well, but I can't jump numbers one and two, right? He wants to force her back into the relationship. That could be a situation. And to be clear, the cases that we deal with, the couples have been separated on average when we take on an active aguna case, 3 to 4 years, right? We're not talking about a few weeks or maybe even a few months after their separation, where maybe there's a chance for reconciliation. This is years after their separation. Sometimes they're already civilly divorced, right? But he says, I want to force her back into the relationship. So what are motivations one and two?
Children and money.
Children and money, right? And your name is, sorry? You're Caleb, right? It's Caleb. Caleb said, children, well, money, right? And children. Money breaks down into blackmail or extortion. Blackmail is, let's say, over the course of their divorce process, he's not going to hold a gun to her head to force her to agree to his financial settlement, but he'll hold a get over her head to say, I'm not going to give you your freedom unless you agree to everything that I'm demanding in the civil divorce process. That's blackmail. Extortion would be a situation where, let's say, they're already civilly divorced, they've divided up their assets, and he says, I'll give you the get, but what's the price tag on your freedom? Is it $500,000, $1 million in exchange for your freedom? Custody. Issues of custody and visitation are extremely sensitive, and the goal from a civil law perspective and a halakhic perspective is to reach a resolution which is in the best interests of the children. What's best for the kids? Not which parent has a better lawyer, but rather what's best for the kids. And so if a couple can't agree on what's best for their kids in terms of custody and visitation, it's incumbent upon them to turn to a third objective neutral party to make a determination for them. And so let's say they've turned to a civil court or to a Beitin or child psychologist to make that determination for them. A recalcitrant husband may say, I don't care what that third objective neutral party has determined to be in the best interest of our children. I want more. I want greater access to the children. I want you to have less access or no access to the children. And so he's using the get as leverage in order to gain access to the children. As we mentioned before, spite, not that he's looking to gain anything from her, but simply to pain her out of spite or quote-unquote love. Right, and the reason I put it in air quotes, and that's been an issue in the news of the past week, but the reason I put it in air quotes is because, again, we're not. It takes two to tango, right? The message that he's not getting is she's just not that into you, and you can't force someone to be in a relationship that they're not interested in being in. And we're not talking about a few weeks or a short period of time. There may still be a chance for reconciliation. We're dealing with years after their separation, where, generally speaking, the reasons for their separation were due to major problems in the marriage, and especially an abusive dynamic within the marriage. And what this all underlies is that get refusal in and of itself is a form of domestic abuse. Because domestic abuse is defined not by black and blue marks, but by a pattern of controlling behavior. It's about a repeated assertion of power and control from one partner over the other, and that's exactly what's going on in every case of get refusal. He's trying to control her, whether it's to extract financial or custodial concessions from her, to control her, to pain her out of spite, or to control her in order to force her back into the relationship. And so what I'm going to do for you now is play for you an excerpt of a conversation that I had with Steve, right? We saw the copy of the Seiruv, the Order of Contempt, issued by the Beit Din of America. And you'll hear in his own words his motivations for refusing to give a get.
I'm very well aware of what the get is. I'm very well aware of what Mrs. Shear wants. I'm very well aware of your history. And if you continue to call me, I'm going to go after you. I'm going to go after Josh. How'd that sound?
That doesn't really scare me, Steve. I've heard that so
many times. Well, you know what, Jeremy? Why don't you come to Roanoke and ask me for the get yourself if you're such a big man? Steve, the gets not open for discussion.
Steve, I want this to be amicable. I want this to be done peacefully, but you're going to have to understand that if you're not going to do this peacefully, then we will have no other choice but to use all legal remedies available to us. Steve, it's not in your best interest.
It's
not in your best interest.
I want you to come to my office and stage a parade with all your little signs. Do it, man. Go ahead. I want you to post my name on your website and try to embarrass me in front of the public. You go.
Why do you want that? What do you want out of the get?
I don't want the get. She's not getting a get.
Why?
You're not getting anything. You're
why?
In no position to ask me for anything.
Why aren't you going to give
her a get? Go back and pray for one for her, okay? Dude. Put my name on your website tomorrow.
It's not just about putting your name
your
on my website.
Stage your parade.
Steve, why are you doing this?
Listen to his answer.
Why are you doing this?
Why? Because this is what I want to happen.
Why?
I don't have to account to you. Do not call me anymore. Any further phone calls will be considered harassment. This is the deal. You do not call me anymore. You do not call my family or friends anymore. Otherwise, there will be repercussions.
Okay, I want to know a yes or no answer. Are you going to give her a get?
No.
No.
He's a real sweetheart, isn't he?
So what's his motivation for refusing to give a get? Spite. Right? And you can hear, he says, I say, why are you doing this? He says, why? Because this is what I want to happen. It's about his assertion of power and control over her. And I think it's just a clear example of the fact that get refusal is not just a violation of halacha, but it's abusive in and of itself. Very briefly, this is an example of a ruling issued by the Beit Din of America against a guy named Yechiel Friedman, which states explicitly the social sanctions that should be issued against him, which include that this is... this paragraph over here, number 3, that he not be given any honor or recognition, nor be granted any right or privilege of participation within liturgical services on any occasion whatsoever. So we have no aspiring attorneys here or attorneys here in the room, but written in wonderful legalese, what it means, he shouldn't be welcome at a shul or allowed to daven with a minion. That's what it means. And Yechiel Friedman is a case that we'd been working on for a few years. And he had the unfortunate privilege of being in a minion that I was in. It was a Mincha Maariv minion in YU. And we had a Mincha, and I turned around and I saw Yechiel Friedman there. And so the following ensued.
Whoa.
You're not welcome. You can leave now. So not have any Maariv until you leave.
No,
we have to go to work. No, this guy is Nesar of Lavola Din. He's refused to give his wife a get for well over a decade. You can leave now. Let's go. Yes, my name is Rabbi Jeremy Stern. You've seen me before. Please leave. We can't daven. This guy's refused to give his wife a get for many, 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 many years. About 18 years, if I recall correctly. You're not welcome to daven here. You're Masarev Lavola Din to the Bezin of America. Take a picture, Yechiel. I have no problem with that. I'm not the one who's paranoid. Give your wife a get, and you're more than welcome to daven here, anytime. You can daven for the Yamud as well. 18 years.
Check your records,
is what he says.
It might be 19, you're right. It's 2015 already.
Check your records. What
Bezin? The Bezin of America has issued a seriv against you. The Bezin of America has issued a seriv against you. The Bezin of America has issued a seriv against you. There's no seriv against her. The Bezin of America issued a seriv against you. Give your wife again. 18 years, Yechiel. It's ludicrous. You're a Russia. So that was pretty intense. That video went viral and played really a key role in that case. But in all of these situations, what we'd really like to do is prevent these cases from happening. Excuse the pun, from the get-go, right? To prevent them from happening. And we can do that with the halachic prenuptial agreement. So the halachic prenup is an agreement that a couple signs before they get married, and it has been 100% successful in preventing these types of cases. And so what we're trying to do is put me out of business, which would be an amazing thing if everyone would sign a halachic prenup. So what does it say? I didn't realize the text here is very small.
So I'll just summarize it, which is that number one, it's a legally binding agreement, which means that it's not only halakhically binding, but it's enforceable in United States civil courts. And so what it does, it empowers the Beitin to make a ruling on the get and the ketubah and things like that, and have that ruling enforceable in the civil courts. And what this does, it addresses the problem, which is that, what we talked about before, that one of the major factors which contributes to the Agunah crisis today is the fact that the Beitin can issue a ruling, and then what, right? They can't put him in jail, they can't seize his assets, they can't garnish his wages, they can't fine him or penalize him or anything along those lines. What this does, this rectifies that problem by empowering the Beitin and giving them enforcement power for their ruling, specifically for financial aspects. And what it does, it adds a tool which the Beitin can use to try and compel the husband to issue the get once he's been deemed recalcitrant. So what it states, that's the second page. The husband obligates himself through this document to pay his wife $150 per day for every day that they're separated until he issues her a get. And we use a reciprocal version in my office, which also requires the wife to pay the husband $150 per day for every day that they're separated and she refuses to receive the get. Now, who determines what's considered refusing to issue or refusing to receive? It's all done under the auspices of the Beitin. So the Beitin can look at the situation, and if a couple separates, and a month after their separation, they finally get around to making the Beitin appointment and doing the get. No one's going to have to pay anyone anything. It's only once the Beitin sees that one party is recalcitrant and refusing to issue the get that they then have to pay the other party, the aggrieved party, $150 per day. What we've seen is that this has been extremely effective, and it's been tested in civil court, it's been tested by many attorneys, and there have been many cases heard in front of the Beitin, and every single time it's worked. And so why has the prenup been so effective? So number one, it's a shtar berurin, which means it's a binding arbitration agreement to one Beitin and only one Beitin, meaning all of the game playing that goes on. As I mentioned before, if the husband says, well, you know, Rabbi Zirkin and myself and Caleb, we're all like real buddies of this guy, and so therefore we're going to rule in his favor. So he wants to go to the Jewish Center 4th floor Beitin, and the wife says, I don't want to go to the Jewish Center 4th floor Beitin. Rabbi Zirkin doesn't like me, and so therefore I don't want to go to that Beitin, right? And you have this battle of this turf war between different batei din. This eliminates all of that game playing and forum shopping that goes on and binds the couple to go to one Beitin and only one Beitin, namely the Beitin of America, which is the largest Beitin, to my knowledge, outside of Israel, affiliated with the Orthodox Union, the Rabbinical Council of America, Yeshiva University, essentially all the mainstay institutions of modern Orthodoxy. That's number one. Number two, the financial support obligation, which I think is effective even for the rich and famous. Up until this was like a big political issue, I used to refer to this as the Ivanka Trump rule, but now like I realize it has all sorts of other implications. But bear with me for a moment, which is that when Ivanka Trump married Jared Kushner, so Rabbi Lookstein was Masada Kiddushin for them, and Rabbi Lookstein uses halachic prenuptial agreements. And so the halachic prenup is stated at $150 per day for a support obligation, because it's assumed that $150 per day, which is $55,000 a year after tax, will cover basic living needs, food, clothing necessities, things like that, food, clothing, shelter, things like that. Now, Ivanka Trump, I assume her standard of living is probably slightly higher than $55,000 a year to cover her food, clothing, and shelter. And so therefore, you can add a zero if you're extremely wealthy and signing a halachic prenup if your standard of living is $550,000 a year, or maybe hers, you'd add two zeros, $5.5 million a year, right, to cover food, clothing, and shelter for a year. But even so, even if Ivanka and Jared, and they should live and be well and have a wonderful marriage, but if someone like them had a situation where they wanted to use halachic prenup, and it only said $55,000 a year, I still think it will be effective. And the reason being is that An attorney said this to me. I thought it was a great line about two weeks ago. She said, people only litigate things if they have a lot of money or a lot of anger, right? The reason, what drives contentious divorces is not the money, but rather the desire to prove the other person wrong. I've seen so many cases where people will pay their attorneys more money than what they stand to gain from the other side.
Why? Because they're essentially saying, I'd rather pay my attorney $500,000 than let my wife, you know, get $300,000 from our financial assets. It's about proving the other person wrong. And what the halachic prenup does is that it this financial support obligation essentially immediately points the finger in the direction of the husband and states, you're doing the wrong thing. Right, and because of that, you have to pay. You have to be an open-ended ATM for your wife until you finally decide to do the right thing. So the financial support obligation, I think, is really effective. As I used this pun before, in the door from the get-go, gets the couple in the door of the Beit Din early on in the divorce process, before the husband becomes entrenched in his recalcitrance. Before it's been a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and only then does the wife ask for the get. Early on in the divorce process, where, as I mentioned, everyone wants to look good in the divorce process, show that the other person is wrong, that they're right, especially in the eyes of the judge. They don't want to have, be seen as the party that's doing the wrong thing. So gets them in the door of the Beit Din early on in the divorce process. No one wants to be called a liar, right? You're essentially signing that you're going to do the right thing, and people's standing and people's good name means a lot to them. And finally, and I think this is really important, failure to sign the halachic prenup is a red flag for abusive behavior. And I say this all the time. If a guy is not willing to sign the halachic prenup, I don't think he's ready to get married. Because what he should be saying to his fiance is, I love you so much and I care about you so much that no matter what, I never want to hurt you. And people lose their heads in divorce and they can hurt each other. So what he's saying is he's making a commitment to her that no matter what, he never wants to hurt her. The guy can't say that to his fiance. I don't think he's ready for marriage. And I would counsel any woman who asks her fiance to sign the halachic prenup, and he says, no, I'm not interested in doing that. That's really a red flag for abusive behavior, because he has to be able to make that statement to her and that commitment to her. And I think we should see signing the halachic prenup as a romantic thing, right? Because, and I actually, just to show that I practice what I preach, this is the halachic prenup my wife and I signed 11 years ago. I like rom-coms and a bit of romantic, but I thought it was a romantic thing for me to do. Because what I was saying is I love and care about you so much that no matter what, I never want to hurt you. And so people often push back and say, how can you sign, how can you talk about divorce at the time of marriage? We're happy, excited, getting ready for our wedding day. And so the answer is that this is not casting aspersions on your marriage, but it's affirming your commitment to each other, that you will always respect each other and never want to hurt each other. And the other point is that the ketubah is also not a romantic document, with love poetry or anything like along those lines. The ketubah, which we read under the chuppah and put up on the walls of our homes, is a financial document that deals with death and divorce. That's what the ketubah actually says, if you were to translate the Aramaic. And no one ever says, oh, I can't have a ketubah because it's casting aspersions on my marriage. No, it's affirming your commitment to one another, that even in the worst of times, you will provide for one another. I'll conclude with our last video, then I'm happy to take any additional questions.
I left after the first time my husband hit me. Even after years of emotional abuse, I wasn't going to let my boys think it's okay to hit their wives.
Under the chuppah, we bless every young couple who gets married that they should have a happy marriage, and we hope that will certainly be the case. But unfortunately, we know that every so often there is a woman whom we refer to as an aguna, and the husband refuses to give her a get, and this is a serious problem.
I didn't have a halachic prenup to protect myself. My husband thought he could blackmail me. He told me he would only give me a get if I waived his obligation to child support. I didn't have the money to support my children on my own. I wouldn't give in to his extortion. I was left in aguna for 6 years.
When my ex-husband refused to give me the get, I felt trapped and helpless. I didn't know if and when I would finally receive my get.
Domestic abuse is not just about black and blue marks, but about a pattern of controlling behavior. Get refusal is an abusive act which we must never excuse or justify.
We each have a responsibility to protect everyone in the community from the tragedy of get refusal. There's one prospective solution that can prevent this form of abuse, the halachic prenuptial agreement.
I helped draft the halachic prenup because withholding a get was a perversion of Jewish law. Avraham Nachemi Goldberg originated the idea and endorsed it, as did Rabbi Avadia Yosef, and more recently, from Usher Weiss and other Gedolim have endorsed it as well.
The prenuptial agreement is the halachic solution to this problem, and we would certainly encourage all the parents and all the rabbanim and the young couples to fill out such a document before they get married.
By signing the halachic prenup, you're making a commitment to your fiancé that no matter what, you don't want to hurt them. You're sending a powerful message to each other and to others of true love, care, respect, and commitment to a community built on those values.
I wished I had the prenup, but when I got married, nobody knew about it.
I didn't sign the halachic prenuptial agreement because I didn't know about it.
We have a solution that has worked 100% of the time, the halachic prenuptial agreement. This crisis can end with us.
Remember, friends
don't let
friends
get married
without the prenup.
So if your friend says to you, Naomi, I want you to be a bridesmaid at my wedding, or Ilan, I want you to be a groomsman, or an aid kiddushin, or what have you, what you say to them is, I'm honored, thank you, I'd love to, as long as you sign a halachic prenup. That's what friends tell their friends to get married without the halachic prenup is. It's the expectation that we have of our rabbis to only be Masada Kedushin when a halachic prenup is signed. And that's the expectation we should have of ourselves and of our friends and our family. And that's how we can standardize it. If we can effectively inoculate the community from the plight of Agunot, I'd thankfully be able to go out of business. So thank you all so much. I'm happy to take any questions that you have. Questions. Gotta have questions.
If someone refuses to give his wife a get in America and then he goes to Israel, is there anything that they can do or no?
Great question. So it hasn't been tested yet in a civil court. The prevailing assumption is that, the legal theory, I guess, is that developed countries recognize the contracts and treaties of other developed countries, and so Israel and the United States, contracts are signed in one country and enforced in the other, and vice versa. If that were to happen, then the Beit Din would issue a ruling to be enforceable by the civil courts here, and then you'd have an enforcement of a foreign judgment in Israel and be enforceable in Israel as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Investigation. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that this has kind of become a more exposed outside the Jewish community as well, and how that has affected cases in your experience?
That's a good question. So a few years ago, when we were dealing with a case that was pretty high profile, we were hesitant to bring it to the attention of the broader media and things like that. Because people said, we're airing our dirty laundry out in public. And that was our initial hesitation. But what we realized is that bringing it to the attention of the broader public can be really effective in these cases. And I'll give you a story. I was at a conference a few years ago, which was a really interesting conference at Boston College, exploring divorce in Catholicism, Protestantism, and Judaism. And I was one of the presenters on Judaism. Rabbi Yonah Reis was one of the other presenters. And the second day of this conference, they had a discussion between all of the panelists. And they invited us to ask each other questions. And so one of the questions that I asked the other panelists, all the other panelists, Catholic priests and Protestant ministers, was that people often push back on our advocacy at ORA, and we don't beat up recalcitrant husbands, but it's the same idea of getting it into the broader media. People push back and say, you're airing out the Jewish community's dirty laundry out in public. And I said, and people say that we're sullying in the eyes of the non-Jewish public, the Jewish people and Judaism. And so I said, now that you've learned from me in this conference about, get refusal and agunot, is your opinion of Jews and Judaism sullied? Do you feel less? Do you see that, there's a problem, and now you think less of Jews and Judaism? So a Catholic priest answered the question. He said, let me tell you something.
all faith communities have problems. It's so much worse to shove it under the rug and pretend it doesn't, and to try and keep it quiet and pretend that it doesn't exist, and then you really have problems with the broader public, than saying, we all have issues, right? And here we are addressing it. And I feel that communities are judged not by the problems they face, but by how they face their problems. And here we're saying we have a problem, we're addressing it. We have a solution with halachic prenup, and we as a community are standing up and saying, here's an abuser, but not an abusive community. We are a community that's standing on behalf of the victim and saying we won't tolerate this type of abuse within our midst. I think that's not a chilul Hashem, that's a kiddush Hashem. Yeah. It's a good question. So there's no silver bullet with these things. When we started off, we used to it was just a bunch of college students, and they organized peaceful demonstrations all the time. And at this point, the public protests are a small fraction of the work that we do, and it's generally like the end of the line. It's the last thing that we'll do. We'll try and ramp up the pressure before it becomes a point where we're going to have a protest rally. Often, it will be the case that it's the threat of the rally which gets the guy to give the get. Sometimes there'll be one demonstration, sometimes two demonstrations, sometimes 20 demonstrations before it will happen. And you know, we've had cases, there's 15, 20, 25, protest rallies. And if someone would have turned to us, it was 20 protest rallies that convinced a guy to give the get. After number 18 or 19 and said, 18 rallies and still he's not giving yet, you're wasting your time, right? Eventually it was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it was the culmination of all the pressure. So that's one aspect. Another reason why these protests are so important is because what abusers do in the domestic abuse in general is they try and point the blame and put the focus on the victim and say, oh, she's the one who does everything wrong. She deserves it. She's a terrible person. And what this does, it redirects the attention onto the abuser and says, what you're doing is wrong, and we're here to support her and say that we won't tolerate what you're doing within our community. And so I think that's really effective. It sends an important message to the community. It's an educational message to the community. And I think it also has a deterrent effect, which is that if we have a protest rally here on 86th Street, we shouldn't have the need one, but we actually had a case 2 years ago that it was due to the protest rallies that got the guy to give the get. We had rallies, it was on the 60s, I think, where we had a rally. We had a rally in the 60s, right? On the west side. And let's say a few blocks over, there's another man who's recently separated from his wife, and his attorney or his uncle or his cousin or his brother or his friend is saying, hey, you should refuse to give a get. You can use it as leverage for this and the other thing. And he looks down the block and he sees in the Shul Bulletin, protest rally against recalcitrant husband for refusing to give his wife a get. That will have a deterrent effect. He may say, you know, it's not worth it for me to jump off that cliff because I see the consequences of doing so. So I think it has that deterrent effect as well. Yeah.
I just want to add, I was digging through my emails as you were talking.
Yeah.
Because for those who were here in 2014, that's exactly what happened. I just found it. Google's a great thing. From December 23rd, 2014, the shul got an email from Yonatan Klayman, who's working,
okay.
I don't know if he's still there now.
Yeah, yeah.
But working at ORA. And he sent us a load of documentation to justify what was happening, which was exactly what we would have needed.
Yeah.
He sent it to us. He sent it to every shul in the neighborhood. There's a guy who, I think the point of the story was, he had moved here to get away from the harassment he was receiving other places. And he had just moved to the west side. Nobody knew him. He thought he would just kind of incorporate himself in a new Jewish community. And Orah tracked him down very quickly.
Yeah.
There was a sign up in every shul. It was in every shul bulletin in the neighborhood. A rally was scheduled outside his house for a Sunday morning. In the middle of the week, they sent it to us. We said, there's no way it's going to make the Shabbat bulletin. And it did, because all the documentation came through. And we scheduled a rally. We had a whole bunch of people from the shul that volunteered to go, as did the other shuls in the neighborhood. And then we got an email Erev Shabbos from Orah that he gave a get.
Yeah.
And it was before the rally was on Sunday. So it was an amazing...
And that was a case, actually, it's interesting, because it was a case that we'd worked on for like 8 years. And what happened is he was in Baltimore, and we had our rallies in Baltimore, and then he moved to Silver Spring. Or he went incognito, and we tracked him down, he moved to Silver Spring. We were going to have rallies there, he moved there to the five towns. We were going to pressure him there, he moved from there to Stamford. We had a rally there, he moved from Stamford to the west side. And then he was dating here on the west side. And he did not like the fact that women that he'd be interested in dating would know that there are protest rallies every Sunday afternoon outside of his apartment building. It's not so, lowers him on the shidduch totem pole or something. So, and so that had an effect. And that I think was actually the second rally that we had on the west side. We definitely had one on the west side, and then before we had that next one, he agreed to give the get. Yeah. Yeah. No, I wish we did, and we've been thinking about trying to put together a grant to do like a proper statistics on these things, so like a real poll on Jewish divorce. But people ask, how many agunot are there, right? So in Israel, the range will be between 150 and 10,000, right? Depending on who you ask. Because, you know, they say they're lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? The issue is that the Rabbanut, for example, is one definition of what an aguna is, and aguna advocacy organizations have a different definition of what an aguna is. So depending on your parameters and how you define what you're trying to count, you can come up with very different numbers. Outside of Israel, it's even worse, because not only do we not have a clear definition of what an aguna is it a woman's been separated from her husband for a day, right? And he says, I'm not giving you a get. Is she an aguna? What about a week? What about a month? What about a year? What if they're not yet civilly divorced? And he says, I'll give you the get after the end of the civil divorce. Or what if she went to civil divorce and he went to Beit Din? There are all sorts of factors that can get involved. So we don't have a clear definition of what an aguna is, nor do we know how many marriages and divorces take place outside of Israel. So we don't have a data set to work with. We don't have a definition to work with. So we just don't have a clear number. All we do know are the stats that we have internally in my organization. In the nearly 300 cases that we've helped resolve, and the scores of cases that we work on at any given time. Yeah.
Please. Do these women usually contact you directly, or someone else says, I've heard of this woman, do you reach out to her? And also, do women ever ask that your involvement isn't so public, if
mm-hmm.
they want it to be more behind the scenes?
So both very good questions. Of the 250 calls that we receive a year, the vast majority of those calls don't become active aguna cases. They're really just like brief services that we provide, guidance, support, referrals, things along those lines. And of those calls, about 10% are on behalf of someone else. So, my sister is going through a difficult time. We need a referral for an attorney. We need to know what Beit Din to go to or things like that. People will call us. When it comes to active aguna cases, we require that the wife calls us. We will not reach out to them because we need to know that they're committed to the process and they're ready for a fight, whether it's a public fight or not. We're not gonna make something public if neither party wants us to do so, right? Generally, the husband is not interested in us making it public, but if the wife also says, I don't want it to be public, we're not gonna do that. We might still work behind the scenes as long as she's okay with that, and we'll do things amicably and quietly. But we're not going to go rogue or anything along those lines.
Kind
yeah.
Of follow up. Do you kind of market yourself in like specific communities that you think women might want your help?
We don't advertise about our advocacy, but what we do advertise is our call line. We about a year and a half ago we started what's called One Step Forward, the Jewish Divorce Resource Line. And that's essentially like a hotline to guide people in the get process and the Beit Din process. They don't teach you in Yeshiva High Schools and Beis Yaakovs about how to get divorced, and it can be an overwhelming and daunting process for anyone. And so we're here to provide guidance, support, referrals, things like that to assist people in that process, and also to try and ensure that the get is issued earlier on in the process before the situation deteriorates. So what was your question specifically? It was. I'm trying to remember what it was. Do we market ourselves? Yes, right. So I knew I was going in a certain direction. So our advocacy, we don't, but One Step Forward, we do. This hotline, we do in order to try and assist as many people as possible in the divorce process. Yeah.
Do you notice that age has any factor on whether or not someone wants to give a get? Meaning, if someone is a above, you know, 60 and above, you know, both parties, and neither are really interested in dating anyone else, that has any impact?
It's hard for me to say because I'm only seeing the people who come to me, right? But I can say the people who come to me across age, hashkafic, denominational, socioeconomic spectrum, got every type. We have, you know, non-Orthodox, Haredi, Hasidish, Yeshivish, modern Orthodox, women in their 20s, women in their 70s, you know, extremely wealthy, extremely poor, impacting basically every major Jewish community and smaller Jewish communities everywhere. We work on cases throughout the world. I mean, obviously, about half of our cases are in Brooklyn because that's where a lot of recalcitrant husbands go. But the reason is because, think about it, right? If you're a recalcitrant husband, they move to Brooklyn. Because even if we get him kicked out of one shul, he just goes down the block to another shtiebel, and they don't know the difference, or they might not even care. And it's easier for these guys to lurk in the shadows. Whereas we often find that agunot go to Teaneck, because Teaneck is a more cohesive community where the rabbis are all on board, and if there is a recalcitrant husband there, he's not going to be welcome. And there's a lot more cohesion and control in addressing these things. So, again, just to answer the question, you know, I only know of the cases that I see, but it's across the spectrum. Yeah. Was there a follow-up to that?
Do you get people signing the halakhic prenup outside of modern orthodoxy, but on both sides?
That's a good question. So it's happening a little bit in more yeshivish circles. We've been trying to make a push, but it's very, very hard. It's more often than not, if someone more yeshivish has a personal connection to it or something along those lines, that they'll sign the halachic prenup. Conservative or reform, also not so much. In the broad spectrum of modern orthodoxy, it's becoming more and more standard. Everything from, like, you know, modern orthodox machmir to open orthodox and whatever, right? So it's becoming more and more. More and more common, and we've been doing a lot to try and standardize it. Yeah.
Are you finding that it's a lot of shuls are instituting it as a requirement?
So one thing that I'm very proud of that we accomplished at Ora is this past year we got the RCA to pass a resolution requiring all RCA rabbis to only officiate at weddings if halachic prenup has been signed. So that's something that we were able to do. But we also do shul programming and work with shuls so that, you know, shuls have it as a standard that even if, you know, that our social hall can't be rented out for a wedding, even if the rabbi's not an RCA member, unless halachic prenup has been signed. Shuls have also been doing, we've been running postnup parties, right? And besides for the prenup, you can have a postnup. A couple that's been happily married for many years can sign a halachic postnup, not because they anticipate divorce, but really, again, to make this a standard throughout the community. Our record so far is a couple that celebrated their 56th anniversary, and they signed a halachic postnup. I think the divorce rate at 56 years is probably relatively low, but it was adorable, and it was to make a standard and to say this is what we expect of our children, our grandchildren, our great grandchildren at that point after 56 years, and so that's what we're trying to do. Yeah. Yeah, so the halachic prenup, I find to be a very elegant document. Here, I'll go back to it over here. Because it very carefully navigates the halachic and civil legal issues. In that it has been tested in court and been upheld. There was one case in particular where the judge wrote an opinion enforcing it. There have been other cases as well where the halachic prenup has been enforced. So it works very carefully within the civil legal system to ensure that it's enforceable and also deals with the halachic concepts.
Follow-up.
Yeah.
Okay. most people I know have said when they get married, their rabbi says they will absolutely will not marry them without signing the document, but which is a good thing. On the other hand, again, from the secular legal standpoint, then you aren't coercing
people. Oh, yeah. So one thing that's important is that it should not be signed under duress, right? So let me clarify that the last week freedom has been 100% successful in cases of recalcitrance where a copy was extant, okay? So if you don't have a copy of what you signed, it's not going to be enforceable, and it was properly signed, okay? So there was a case in New Jersey that the judge threw it out because right before the husband walked down the aisle, the rabbi said, sign this, and if you don't sign this, everyone's going home. Right? So that's signing it under duress. You didn't have an opportunity to read through it and agree to the terms. But if the rabbi is saying, these are my standards, this is what I expect, if you want me to do you a service by serving as your Masada Kedushin, and we're going to sit down a month before your wedding, I think one day we'll be at a point where engagement parties are prenup signing parties. That'd be awesome, right? So months before the wedding, they sit down, they've had an opportunity to review the document, the rabbi or their attorneys or whoever reads through it and they agree to the terms, they sign it and it's properly notarized, that's going to be enforceable. Yeah. Yeah.
There's an article a few weeks or months ago, a statement by the Rabbanut about the statistics of get refusal,
uh-huh,
and particularly the refusal of women to accept a get from the husband when he does want to give it.
Yeah.
So I've been dying to ask you this question.
Okay.
Since I read it. So, A, what's your sense living in Israel? What's going on there? And B, do you guys encounter those kinds of situations?
Right. So we have had and do deal with cases of recalcitrance by the women. About 1% of our cases have been cases where the wife has refused to receive the get. It's never come to the point of 1-2% of our cases. It's never come to the point of a protest rally. It's been the buildup has been successful in convincing the wife to receive the get. But let's just say 98% of our cases have been situations where the husband has refused to issue the get rather than the wife refusing to receive the get. Domestic abuse statistics in general, this is very contested, but there's one theory out there. What's been the predominant theory is that 85% of perpetrators of domestic abuse are male and 15% of the victims are female. And so what we're seeing in this form of domestic abuse is just following along that trend in domestic abuse in general. Now, the Rabbanut statistics are very interesting because, again, they're defining their terms, right? And so the Rabbanut actually says that there are more cases of agunim than there are agunot. And that's interesting because we find 98% to 2%, and they're saying 55% or 98 to 2, they're saying 45 to 55, right? That's a big disparity, a very, very, very big disparity. And so I'll just explain what many of the Aguna active advocacy organizations in Israel have been saying. We at ORA don't work on specifically Israeli cases, work in cases that bridge Israel and the diaspora or diaspora cases, but not strictly Israeli cases. So I can't really comment on individual cases in Israel. But what the Aguna advocacy organizations in Israel have been saying is that, yes, when you define a case where the wife wants to the wife the Beit Din rules that the wife has to give up, you know, her financial assets in order to receive the get, right? And she says, I'm not willing to give up the financial assets to receive the get. They say, oh, you're making him an agun because you're refusing to receive the get. No, I'm refusing to receive a conditional get, right? So depending on how you define your terms, it seems that the Rabbanut these statistics have a much stricter definition to define an aguna than they have to define an agun. And so that might account for the disparity between our statistics and theirs. Yeah, it could also be that Israeli women are just tougher than, you know, American women. That could be a factor. I guess one thing to add, though, is that if you have a non-religious couple in the United States, let's say, and a get is not important to them, they don't care about a get,
you know, they weren't even married under Orthodox auspices, and you know, the husband's not going to be trying to issue the get, the wife won't be receiving the get. It's a non-issue. But in Israel, they don't have a separation between religion and state. The Beit Din is the state court which officiates for marriages and divorces. And so the only way that you can get divorced as a Jew in the state of Israel is through the Rabbanut. So you might have an Israeli woman who's secular, she's anti-religious, and she says, good, I'll refuse to receive the get, I don't care, I have a boyfriend, I don't care about this religion thing, right? I'm going to refuse to receive the get because I can use it as leverage for my husband, who's also not religious, but the only way that he can get divorced is through the rabbinical court. So because secular Israelis are also forced to utilize the rabbinical courts, that may skew the statistics as well. So that's another factor. Yeah. Last question. Okay, yeah. Come on.
What percentage of women that come to you for help end up, like, giving up, like, on the get, like, process and just, like, say...
That's a really good question. It's amazing and inspiring. Very few. These women will let me say it differently. Kind of what's expressed by them is, he's taken away so many things from me. He's taken away so many years of my life, childbearing years in particular. I'm not going to let him take away my belief system, my belief in God, and my religion, right? And so I'm not going to let him take that away from me. And because of what he's doing, therefore give up my system of faith and belief. And so there are women who will suffer for many years, you know, because they're not willing to give up on their belief in God, their belief in Judaism, and the sanctity of halacha and the halachic process. And so very few, from what I've seen, again, they're turning to us, so they've already committed to the process. Very, very few say after a few years, okay, you know what, I'm giving up. I'm just going to live with the boyfriend, and that's it. Yeah. Less than a percentage of the cases that we've dealt with. Yeah. Last question? Okay. Okay. Sure.
Can you tell us what this has taught you about your marriage, about Jewish marriage, from being in the trenches? Has it affected the way that you think about what marriage can and should be?
Wow. I've been doing this for 10 years. I've never been asked that question before. Okay. What has it taught me about marriage? Repeat the question again. Let me stall to.
What has it taught you about marriage from being in the trenches in the worst of cases, coming out of there, in your own marriage or Jewish marriage in general?
I think dealing in issues of abuse, I hope my wife would say the same thing. I like to think that I'm more sensitive to these issues. In the language that I use and the way that I interact with my wife and with other people. In our office, we're talking about abusive relationships all the time, and so hopefully there's a heightened awareness and there's a self-awareness that applies to us as well in our own relationships. I think that's in terms of that personal perspective. In terms of how has it impacted my view of marriage and things like that, I think seeing that marriage is really a partnership between the two parties, and seeing what a healthy relationship can look like and what an abusive relationship can look like, and that. You know, when I was getting smicha, you just had the chag of smicha at YU. When I was getting smicha, and you had like a whole bunch of interviews with various administrators and, you know, Rosh Yeshiva in YU. And so one of the administrators asked me, he said, in dealing with divorce every day, right, like, and you've seen all this corruption in Batei Din, in rabbis and things like that, has that weakened your faith in the halachic system and in rabbis being the purveyors of Jewish tradition? And I said, to the same extent that I've seen bad rabbis doing terrible things and corrupt things and abusive things and corrupt Batei Din, I've also seen other rabbis stand up for the right thing, stand up for the vulnerable and the oppressed, and make a difference in the lives of the most vulnerable members of our society. And that's inspiring. And so I think in being in the trenches and seeing the dirty underbelly of the Jewish community, you can also see the beauty of what a marriage can be and healthy relationships, that healthy relationships are about mutual respect and trust and openness and honesty and communication. And I think it's essentially put that in relief, right? Seeing the worst also helps you, enables you to see the good and see the beauty in Judaism and in marriage. So on that positive note, thank you all so much.
Thank you so much for joining. It was really great hearing about all the important work that Aura is doing. And
see, I am happily married. This is
hopefully everyone here is encouraged to sign a halachic prenup before you get married, and if you are already married and you did not sign a halachic prenup, to do a postnup agreement.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not following the Jewish Center Young Leadership Committee on Facebook, please do, and you'll hear about all of our lectures going forward and all the events going forward that we have planned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. There are pens in the back. Free pens. Swag.
And you can do a file. Really fast.
Don't mind if I do.
So much.
Sure, thank you. Thanks for helping over.
I think you earned a l'chaim.
Okay, I'm happy to. Sure.
Where do you see, besides the development of more and more people signing the prenup and postnup, where do you see Aura's efforts in the next 5 to 10 years of trying to?
Good question. I think our next level in
people
who are
traveling and things like that,
and we're seeing more and more of that.
No,
so
people
who are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people
who
are
traveling,
people